thousands of kits that document evidence of rape sitting untested all around the state. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening on this chilly Tuesday morning. I'm Melissa Ross. The show's always live at 9. And now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, details on Florida's huge backlog of untested rape kits and what's being done about it. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Also this morning, women in media, why they're still underrepresented on all platforms and why it matters. We'll talk to three local women, plus the shifting alliances across the Middle East, how you can take part in the local library's important discussion this month, all of that ahead. But first this morning, a new study finds a huge backlog of untested rape kits across Florida, at least 13,000 of them. Now, there are nearly 1,500 untested kits in Duval County alone, that according to the FDLE. Managing that backlog could cost as much as $32 million. This study is under review in Tallahassee as the 2016 legislative session kicks off next week. Meanwhile, State Representative Janet Atkins says she's introducing legislation to reduce the backlog of untested rape kits. She's on the line now with more and takes your calls. Janet Atkins, thanks for being on the line with us this morning.
It's good to be with you, Melissa.
And when it comes to this issue of untested rape kits around Florida, and any questions you have for State Rep. Janet Atkins, get on the line now. 549-2937 to join the discussion. That's 549-2937. Or just go to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so we're learning this morning that there are 13,000 untested kits all over Florida, Representative Atkins. The backlog is actually even bigger than we had earlier thought. The numbers are, quite frankly, shocking.
I can tell you, Melissa, I was both saddened and angry when I heard these numbers. It's a reasonable expectation for victims of sexual assault that when an evidence kit is collected, that something is done with that kit, that the evidence is tested and it's analyzed. That's a reasonable expectation, and it's just really disappointing to learn that so many of these sexual assault kits have sat on shelves and have gone untested.
And what do we know about the reason for this, both here in Northeast Florida and across the state? It's largely due to a lack of funding and manpower, isn't it?
Well, I mean, I hear that, but to me, I think that the real problem lies in the fact that there's no statewide, no state statute that really mandates under what criteria, under what guidelines do you submit the sexual assault kit for testing. And so that's what we've done with House Bill 179. When this story first broke last year, last summer, we began looking at formulating legislation that would set a statewide standard under what circumstances should these sexual assault kits be sent for testing. And so I'm pleased with the work that we've been able to accomplish over the last several months, working with the Attorney General's Office, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the Sheriff's Association, the Police Chiefs Association, and with the Rape Crisis Centers.
And all of these stakeholders will work together. Tell us a little bit more about this legislation that you've just filed and how it would change the process by which these kits would get tested in a more timely manner, I suppose.
Sure. So as we begin looking at the issue and looking at the thousands of sexual assault kits across Florida and across the nation, we learned that there is no state requirement in Florida that they be submitted in a timely fashion. So we began working with all of the stakeholders. I can tell you that we've already passed through the first committee of reference. We have two more committees to go. But basically, it creates a timeline of 30 days for submission of evidence to either a local or to a statewide criminal analysis laboratory. Now, that's 30 days from when the evidence is collected and a police report is filed or when the victim requests it. We always want to be mindful of the rights of the victim. If the victim does not want the DNA tested, then but has had it collected but doesn't want it tested, then we're going to respect the victim's rights. But if at any time, let's say 6 months or a year after the crime occurs, and now that victim is at a point emotionally that they want it tested and they want to move forward, then we're establishing 30 days from when within that time frame it would be submitted for testing.
And if you're just tuning in, as we speak about the thousands of untested rape kits all over Florida, what are your questions for State Representative Janet Adkins? Give us a call. We'll go to your calls in just a moment at 549-2937. Here in our area, Janet Adkins, the Fourth Circuit State Attorney's Office serving Clay, Duval, and Nassau counties received about $3 million in grants to test some of these kits. What about some of the impediments? Oh, let's say this legislation gets passed. Are you concerned at all about funding and follow through, making sure that this mandate, because it seems like a slam dunk, quite frankly, I mean, who would be against this, voting for this? But what about the actual follow through and the funding to make sure it gets done?
Well, absolutely. The appropriation needs to be aligned with the policy. And I'll be meeting with the Florida Department of Law Enforcement next week when I return to Tallahassee for legislative session to talk with them about how we can move that appropriation request forward. You know, but when you look at this issue of all of these test kits that have gone untested, and you look at what's happened in other states, for instance, you look at Detroit. They discovered, they counted they had 8,707 untested kits. They tested 2,000 of those, of which they found 760 matches, of which 188 of those matches were serial offenders. So when you think of the serial nature of this particular crime, then you have to absolutely understand that when you're able to find a match and prosecute and put these individuals in prison, behind bars, then you are keeping Floridians safe because you are potentially eliminating and avoiding future sexual assault crimes. And that's important to every Floridian, whether you're a woman, whether you're a husband, a father, a son, that's important to you.
And what do you attribute this backlog to ultimately all over the country, not just here in Florida? Pure old-fashioned sexism, misogyny, law enforcement agencies dragging their feet to prosecute crimes involving violence against women, perhaps?
You know, I'm not going to suggest that there's any ill will behind any of this. As I've talked with the stakeholders, we've talked through this on a purely logical and policy level. There's been discussion of, well, in these particular circumstances, perhaps we should not submit it. Maybe if the victim knows who the perpetrator is, why would we spend the money to the question that has been raised? Why would you analyze it if you know who it is? And as we've talked through that, we've learned that absolutely, there's value in every single sexual assault kit being submitted, because while one victim may know who their perpetrator is, another victim may not know. And so while you may be able to solve another crime by getting that evidence into the database. So as we've talked about this, we've come to the agreement and understanding, I believe, that every assault kit should be tested so that we can receive justice for these victims.
You've introduced this legislation. You've also introduced another piece of legislation involving computer coding. What's that all about?
So in the state of Florida, it's estimated that there's going to be an increase in the number of STEM jobs, whether you're looking at science, technology, engineering, math. But oftentimes our students are not prepared. So this legislation would allow students to substitute a foreign language, if they choose, for a coding language. And so it's simply an option for students. And it's interesting, as we've looked through this policy, I've had parents come to me, and it kind of dovetails quite nicely with the reading bill that I'm working on this session, which focuses on struggling readers. So I've had parents who've come to me to say, you know, I did not know my child had dyslexia until they began taking a foreign language. I've had other parents say, my child absolutely cannot pass the foreign language class because of the reading disability that they have. And so allowing them to take a coding course, a computer coding course, in some ways opens doors of opportunities for all students, including those with who are struggling readers, and helps prepare them for economic success.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment. For State Representative Janet Adkins, the 2016 legislative session kicks off in Tallahassee next week. What are your questions about a whole manner of legislation expected to move? Now, that piece is education related. You're termed out in the legislature. You are a declared candidate for Nassau County Superintendent. That's, of course, that election's quite some time off. But as you look at legislation that's education related, obviously that's something that you're interested in. Let's talk about that for a minute. You're leaving one office and you've got your eye on another. Why did you decide to run for superintendent of Nassau County?
I can tell you, Melissa, I have always been passionate about education. I believe it's the one gift that we can give our children as a community that no one can ever take away. I served on the school board in Nassau County for 10 years prior to serving in the Florida legislature. And while I've served in the legislature, I've served on nearly every education committee there is. I currently serve on four education committees this year. So I'm passionate about education and how it absolutely will transform lives. And so that's why I think it's quite frankly something that God's been putting on my heart for the last 11 years or so. So I'm excited about that, about those opportunities. But let me tell you, I'm absolutely committed to finishing strong in the Florida House this last term. I have a reading bill that I'm very passionate about, dealing with children who have dyslexia and other struggling readers. And so I'm excited about what I believe that legislation will do to transform education in Florida.
Your opponent in the race is Nassau School Board member Kathy Burns. She's also a Republican. It's been speculated that you and Ms. Burns might not see eye to eye on some issues, in particular when it comes to the issue of charter schools. Do you expect that to come up in the campaign?
Yeah, and Melissa, I've always been a supporter of school choice. I've been always been a supporter of a parent's right to choose what is the best educational environment for their child, whether it's homeschool, a charter school, virtual school, private school, or the traditional public schools. So, my record is pretty clear on supporting parents' right to choose what is the best educational environment for their child. That's who I am. That's what I believe. And I'm excited about the opportunity to improve education for all of our students in Nassau County and quite frankly, for the state of Florida as we finish up this last legislative session.
Now, the outgoing superintendent has supported or has given money to your opponent. The fundraising in this race is actually quite healthy considering it's a local superintendent's race. You've drawn fundraising support from all over the state for this race. It shows how important education is for people who are following these superintendent races. Do you expect a hard-fought campaign?
Like I said, Melissa, I am really focused right now on finishing this last legislative session strong. We've got a lot of really good policy and bills that we are putting forth. I'm pleased that, I've drawn support from the entire state of Florida, from colleagues and people that I've worked with for the last 7 years, people that I respect, and I'm very thankful that they respect me to the point that they're supporting me with this next endeavor.
And we'll go to your calls for State Representative Janet Adkins in just a moment. Let's go to a few of your emails and tweets and Facebook comments. Here is an email from Lowell with regard to the rape kits. It seems once again this whole issue reinforces the second-class nature of crimes against women. And here is a comment on our Facebook page from Kimberly. How can these rape kits just sit there? Isn't the DNA the important factor to find and convict the rapist? Does this mean there are stalled court cases waiting until these kits are tested? Representative Adkins, that does mean that, doesn't it?
Well, when you look in 2014, FDLE reported that there were 6,781 forcible rape crimes. When you look at the arrests for that same time period, there was 1,839. And so it's concerning to me, as I've been talking with some of the stakeholders, and they've talked about the priorities of setting priorities of how you submit these rape kits for testing. And to me, that word priorities, they should all be tested. And using the term priorities really angers and frustrates me, to be honest. But as they talked through it, I understood them to say that, well, if you don't know who the perpetrator is, then that's a lower priority. To me, it should be just the opposite. If you have no idea who has sexually assaulted you, those should be some of the first test kits that should be analyzed. But again, as we've talked through the issue, I believe we've now reached the consensus that regardless of whether you know who the perpetrator is or not, those kits need to be tested. I am so thankful that this issue has come to light so that we can now move forward with finding solutions for finding justice for these victims.
And the number to join the show and connect with State Rep. Janet Adkins, 549-2937. Here's a tweet from Mary for you. Florida child sex abuse rates are above the national average. Do we have the percentage of kids that belong to minors or male victims? Is there any data on that? I don't know that there is.
I don't have the numbers on that. What I can tell you from talking with the stakeholders is that even when you look at the number of crimes that were reported and then those that resulted in arrests, there were many more rapes that occurred that just simply were not reported. So this is a crime that happens much too often. And I believe because we are not properly testing these kids, because we are not making this a priority, we are allowing more and more rapes to occur. And to me, that is an absolute travesty, and it must be addressed, and it must be stopped.
Now, this bill, you hope, moves quickly through the process. What else do you anticipate being a priority for your delegation as the legislative session kicks off next week in Tallahassee?
Right. So I mentioned earlier the bill that I'm working on for struggling readers. That's another top priority of mine. When you look at children who have dyslexia, it's estimated anywhere between 15 to 20% of our children have dyslexia on some level. The science tells us how we need to be teaching these children to read. It involves multisensory, explicit, systematic instruction. I had requested Speaker Krista Foley to conduct an APAGA study so that we could look at what our different school districts are doing in terms of teaching struggling readers. How does this compare to other states? Do our teachers have the proper training and development to effectively teach these children? And APAGA just released their report last fall. We have crafted legislation in response to that. What we've learned is that many of our teachers do not have the skills to teach children with dyslexia and other reading disabilities. And so this bill really encompasses several components. One is to try to identify these children earlier. Research shows that you can identify these children as early as pre-K, and if you can provide intervention early between kindergarten, first, and second grade, number one, the intervention is much more effective than waiting until after third grade. And number two, many of these children can, with the proper intervention, can even go through school without even a diagnosis, because you've intervened early. So we focused on early identification, early intervention, and then professional development for our teachers. We have wonderful teachers in Florida, teachers that care about our students, teachers that want to help these children. And yet it's so often frustrating for them because they don't receive the necessary support to be as effective as they want to be. And so making sure that our professional development is aligned properly to give them the skills that they need to help these students, that's the focus of this bill. This bill, House Bill, I believe it's 7129, has already passed through two committees, and we've got one more committee to go. I'm hopeful that we'll get that on the floor of the House very soon, early in session.
Let me ask you as well, just before the new year, Congresswoman Karine Brown filed suit asking a federal judge to void Florida's latest congressional redistricting plan. She, of course, is fighting redistricting of her congressional map. It would change her district that goes from Jacksonville down to Orlando and instead would go from Jacksonville west toward Tallahassee. You recently apologized for comments you made saying black convicts would be key to defeating Congresswoman Karine Brown, packing black prisoners into her district. Now that there have been new developments in her court battle, I was just curious to get your reaction to that and just the fallout over the remarks that you made.
Well, listen, first of all, I believe the comments were taken completely out of context. I was simply trying to restate what the debate had been on the floor of the House as we were debating that bill. So I was simply relating comments that other lawmakers had had made. But listen, the courts have spoken, and they have drawn the districts. It's interesting that a prior court had drawn the district, you know, in the Jacksonville to Orlando method. Now we've got a different court that has drawn it from Jacksonville to Tallahassee. And so the courts have spoken, and I think everything's going to move forward with the maps that the courts have drawn.
You don't anticipate that Congresswoman Brown will be successful in her court fight?
I cannot predict what the courts are going to do or not do.
Well, in hindsight, would you have made those remarks? It was a closed-door meeting, and you know, you weren't aware that there was a reporter from Politico in the room recording audio?
Listen, I've made my comment about that. So, you know, again, I was simply trying to relate the comments that had been presented on the floor of the House.
Let's go to your calls right now for State Representative Janet Adkins. Steve is on Beach Boulevard. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Melissa, thank you for taking my call. Representative Adkins, thank you for your service to our community and to our state. I have a question that kind of steps outside of your area right there, but I'm just curious. In Duval County, where our school board is given the power to elect and ultimately fire our district, our superintendent at will, and does about every 4 to 8 years, and passes out this $300,000 to $400,000 a year job to a gentleman that oversees a budget that's, I would assume, hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm just curious, your opinion. Do you, and you're running for an elected office, not, and you're not asking to be appointed. Do you think Duval County, your neighboring county, would benefit from having our school board superintendent elected, or do you think that we benefit from having a appointed superintendent? I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Well, thanks for the call, Steve. It's an interesting question. So when you look at why do some counties have an elected versus an appointed school superintendent, it all goes back to whether or not that county is chartered. So most of the larger districts, larger counties are chartered, such as Duval. But in Nassau County, we're much smaller. We follow the state constitution, and therefore, like in Jacksonville, your city council members have term limits because that's part of the county's charter. In Nassau County, our county commissioners do not have term limits because we're not chartered. So there's pros and cons for an elected versus an appointed superintendent. I think that clearly the salary is much higher for an appointed superintendent. The appointed superintendent serves at the will of the school board and therefore I think is a little bit more in tune with the will of the various school board members. I think there's pros and cons both ways, but in Nassau County, I can tell you that there was the debate back in around 2000 as to whether or not we should have an appointed or an elected superintendent, and I believe the numbers were well over 70% of the voters in Nassau County said, we want to have an elected superintendent.
They want
but
the...
that would require a change for Duval County's charter.
Right. People in your county prefer the option of voting. It's been a robust discussion, so much ground covered here, and we so appreciate you giving us your time and your thoughts on all of these important issues. Thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you so much. God bless you.
Janet Adkins, state representative from our area, joining us a week in advance of the 2016 legislative session. Much more still ahead on the show. Later, the Jacksonville Public Library hosting an important discussion this month on everything happening in the Middle East right now. We will tell you how you can take part. But up next, women and media. Why, even now in 2016, one half of our population's voice is still not being equally heard. We'll tell you about it right after this.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
On the next Fresh Air, 1,000 Naked Strangers. Former paramedic Kevin Hazard talks about his nearly 10 years answering 911 calls in an ambulance, treating the sick and injured in Atlanta. He writes that much more than the medicine, what fascinated him was the strange world he'd accidentally stumbled upon. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Even in tough economic times, there are many local stories of success. I'm Karen Mathis with the Daily Record. On First Coast Success, I speak with Northeast Florida business executives and entrepreneurs about their experiences and accomplishments. Hear the interviews the last Monday of each month on First Coast Connect or on demand at wjctnews.org.
Brought to you in part by Iberia Bank.
Follow what's happening at WJCT even when you're away from your radio. You can follow WJCT on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can listen live online to WJCT-FM at wjct.org/listen or on iTunes Radio or TuneIn Radio. And you can hear all of your favorite WJCT-FM shows anytime on demand on iTunes and Stitcher. Wherever you are, WJCT is there.
Welcome back. Well, as media coverage of the 2016 presidential election heats up, so too does scrutiny of the media itself. There are two women running for president this year, of course, Hillary Clinton and Carly Fiorina. But according to the Women's Media Center, which tracks the representation of women in all forms of media, women still remain underrepresented in newspapers, on television, on the radio, in film, and in decision-making positions across all of these platforms. This might surprise all of you viewers and readers and listeners, but the numbers don't lie. Here with our thoughts, we welcome three women in media. On the line, Carrie Heaps, radio talk show host and president of Strictly Marketing Magazine. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Melissa. It's so great to be here today.
Oh, great to have you. Also with us, Beth Andrus, CFO of World of Wonder Productions. She produces such Bravo shows as Million Dollar Listing. Hi, Beth. Beth, are you with us? Okay, Beth, we'll try to get you in a moment. And also on the air with us, Michelle Dutrow, host of the Game Changer podcast. Hi, Michelle.
Hello, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And we want your calls about this topic. The number to join us, 549-2937. Carrie, let's start with you. You're host of your own show, and you are the publisher of Strictly Marketing. So you're asked to be a guest on all kinds of programs. And just by judging by your own anecdotal experience, you often find that you're the only woman on the panel, correct?
Well, yes, Melissa, I find with a lot of the different media outlets that we reach out to, so I can be a guest and just, you know, for branding purposes, keep our name out there, talk about the magazine, talk about the radio program. And also, too, I've been asked a couple of different times to sit on panels to do some keynotes, and I typically am in the minority. It's either just myself or perhaps one other woman on board as well.
Michelle, tell us a little bit about your podcast. Let's talk about the positive, first of all, because we do have three women who are on the air, which is good. Tell us a little bit about your podcast, The Game Changer.
Sure. So I interview two different segments of people, if you will. One is people that I consider to be a game changer in some way, shape, or form, truly making a difference. And the other are people that I consider to be experts in the field of mindset, of what mindset does it take that you need to cultivate in order to be a game changer, be that getting past fear, limiting beliefs, whatever that may be. So the show is split into two different categories.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the statistics that come out from every year from the Women's Media Center, for example, by nearly 3-to-1 margin, bylines at top newspapers are authored by men over women by a margin of 3-to-1. Men are twice as likely to be quoted than women in newspaper articles and on television and even on, yes, public radio. On the Sunday TV talk shows, which tend to set the agenda for political coverage, women make up only 14% of guests and 29% of the roundtable panel almost every Sunday. Talk radio and sports talk radio is still overwhelmingly male and actually also white and male. Television news directors are still overwhelmingly male, about 70%. Even obituaries about men still outnumber those of women by a lot. What do you think of those numbers?
Well, I'll tell you, they mirror exactly what statistically I've looked at in podcasting as well. So just looking at podcasting as a medium, if you look at across the two main platforms being iTunes and Stitcher, 80% of all the podcasts are hosted by men. Yet, if you look at listenership of podcasts, it's very nearly 50-50. So it truly makes no sense. And certainly I agree with you, this is an ongoing problem, and it's not one that just women are going to be able to talk about and solve. I love Emma Watson's He for She campaign, because what that speaks to is this is everybody's issue, and men have to be supportive and recognize this for a fact, because you're exactly right, statistics don't lie, and that every one of us has a responsibility to say if this is going to change, then we all need to be actively involved to make it change. My podcast right now is split evenly between men and women that I have on my show, but every podcaster, I think, has the responsibility to ensure that, certainly to recognize who they have as guests on the show and to try to even those playing fields out a little bit, because it is. It's completely lopsided. When 80% of all podcasts out there are hosted by men and 50-50 is the listenership, there's something askew there. So, yes, my statistics match yours completely.
Yeah. Carrie Heaps, women are 54% of the heaviest consumers of media when it comes to radio, TV, print newspapers, and internet. More than half of the consumers. But yet, when it comes to overall representation, far less than half.
Yes, and I'm in agreement with that. My numbers as well for my own magazine and for my podcast are, you know, very similar to what Michelle quoted. We have about a 50-50 or a little bit higher split of male to female listeners and readership. And we field queries for our editorial and also for our guests for our podcast. We field those out every month. And the submissions that we get back are, for every 10 submissions that we have, 9 are male, and we'll have 1 or 2 that are female submissions. So there's definitely more male submissions than there are female. And, you know, what can we do to change that? And I do agree with Michelle. I think, you know, recognizing that there's an issue and working towards, you know, making that change, I would love to see more females submitting for editorial and submitting to be a guest on our podcast as well.
How can they go about that?
Well, we submit queries, field queries through ProfNet every month, and we also put them out on our Twitter feed as well and on our Facebook fan page for the magazine. And we, you know, with our editorial, we welcome, you know, anyone to submit an article, and we have a review process that we go through to choose the best article to go into the magazine or the best submission for a podcast, you know, for, you know, who we're going to have as an upcoming guest. So we definitely encourage people to go online and take a look at that and, you know, just submit their best written article.
Here's another interesting statistic that I find so fascinating. Over the Christmas holiday, I was able to go see several movies, which I hardly ever get to do. And let me just talk about this for a moment. The actress Gina Davis has founded an institute called the Gina Davis Institute on Gender and Media. And the most interesting data point she talks about shows that there are, in almost every major Hollywood film that comes out, especially family films, there are three male characters for every speaking female role, almost universally. And these are family films, right? Not only that, ever since 1946, across the board, in all group and crowd scenes, you will almost always see 17% female characters instead of a 50-50 ratio, which is how it would look in real life. And so Gina Davis, for years, has been trying to get Hollywood directors to, when they cast extras in big crowd scenes, to just simply cast reality, to cast half women and half men in a big crowd scene. For some inexplicable reason, they only put 17% women in a crowd scene. And as she points out, what that message is sending to young girls and boys that go to the movies is that women don't take up enough, don't take up as much space. And that may seem like a small thing, but it's part and parcel of the underrepresentation that we're seeing in the news media. It's the same issue. It's saying that women aren't present. And so let me end on a hopeful note and talk a little bit, Michelle, about your final thoughts about how to change this dynamic. Michelle.
Well, you know, I love how you're ending this because it really is important. It's the subtleties that make the big difference. And this goes all the way back to how we raise our little boys versus little girls. And the one statement that I will tell you for every parent listening to this is every time we say to a little girl, oh, you know what, honey, you can do anything. You could be a doctor. You could be an astronaut. It's almost though we're implying, hey, don't worry. You can get past whatever hurdles there are. Of course you can do it. A little boy doesn't get told that. It's a given, right? I mean, it's an expectation. Whatever you're going to do, absolutely, you need to go do that because that's your role in society. So every time we're using these words of encouragement as though there's some doubt that that couldn't be a possibility, so you've got to have the right mindset to make it so, is its own problem. And there has to be a shift across the board, like I said, in how we're raising our children, what's going on in the media, what is being conveyed, but this is an issue and a topic for all of us. This isn't just something that women need to try to figure out. This truly is an issue for everybody. And now is the time. There are campaigns across the board that we're seeing, and truly everybody needs to be involved. I am very hopeful, and I do believe that things will shift and change, but that starts with every single one of us to include the language that we use when we're talking to our kids.
Carrie Heaps.
Well, I'm in agreement with Michelle with everything that she has shared. And I would say, just in closing, that I think one of the ways that we can fix that problem is, again, with our youth. And also, too, I think just women supporting one another and instilling that confidence in one another. You know, try it. Go for it. If there's, you know, we've talked about the movies. You know, there's so many young women that would love to go and, you know, get into the acting industry. And if that's something that you want to do, you know, go for it. And if it doesn't work out, at least you tried. It's the same thing, too, with, you know, fielding out editorial responses. We would love to see more women submitting editorial specifically for our magazine and for other publications as well. And, you know, if there's a fear inside of you that's holding you back, you just have to kind of, like a good friend of mine has told me before, Marcia Dahl, she said, take your biggest fear and turn it into your biggest thrill. And I think that's something that we really need to kind of instill in our young women and even our women colleagues, you know, people that we work with as well.
Well, thank you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Carrie Heaps, president of Strictly Marketing Magazine and host of Knockout Marketing. Michelle Dutro is host of the Game Changer podcast. In a moment, how you can be part of an important conversation, the shifting alliances in the Middle East.
Hi, this is Michael Feldman, and thanks to WJCT and the Florida Theater. What Do You Know, Y'all? Is coming to Jacksonville on Saturday, February 20th. We're flying down to check out all 22 miles of beach, maybe do us some fish camping. Join us, won't you? Tickets are available at the Florida Theater box office, by phone at 904-355-2787, or online at floridatheater.com. We'll see you there.
So this is interesting. Foreign tourists aren't vacationing here as much as they used to, but when they do, they're doing it on the cheap.
We certainly haven't spent as much this time around as we did the last time we were in New York. We bought jeans and aftershave and perfume, and this time around we've bought very little.
I'm Kai Rizal. Tourism and the strong dollar, next time on Marketplace from APN. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Hello, my name's Walton Goggins. Nice to meet you. I'm from Lithia Springs, Georgia.
That is what the actor Walton Goggins sounded like when he got to Los Angeles as a 19-year-old hoping to become an actor. Then he got some tough advice in acting class.
The first thing he handed me was a book of sonnets by Shakespeare, and he said, you need to lose that accent.
The star of Justified and the new movie The Hateful Eight, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Well, finally this hour, it's America's largest discussion program on world affairs. Great Decisions is an initiative organized by the Foreign Policy Association. Each year, groups nationwide discuss everything from, say, China's foreign policy to the relationship between Israel and the U.S. This month, a big discussion is coming up at the Jacksonville Public Library, the Southeast Branch. It's titled Shifting Alliances in the Middle East. It will be facilitated by UNF's Parvez Ahmed. He joins us now along with the library's executive director, Barbara Gubbin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you both. Barbara, let's start with you. What is the Great Decisions program?
Well, you've already done a great introduction, Melissa. We host it, as you say, at our Southeast Regional Library on Deerwood Parkway. And it's an opportunity for people to come together to talk about really important issues to the United States of America and to the world.
Obviously, right now, Parvez Ahmed, people have a lot of interest in what is happening in the Middle East. You will be facilitating this talk, Shifting Alliances in the Middle East. What does that denote exactly, shifting alliances?
Well, one of the things you saw this week was when Saudi Arabia and Iran cut off relationships with each other after Saudi Arabia executed one of the leading Shiite clerics who was a critic of the Saudi government. And the region is rapidly changing, not just with violence and terrorism, ISIS and others, but also in terms of its ethnic makeup, its political alliances. And all of those have a huge impact on U.S. foreign policy. And foreign policy is going to be an important aspect of the presidential election in 2016.
There are so many questions about what's happening, and there is so much confusion. There's sure to be so much that's discussed and explained, I would guess, at this event. Correct, Barbara Gubbin?
Yes. I mean, the way that these Great Decisions discussions are set up is we have a very informed facilitator, such as Dr. Ahmed, and we have different facilitators for each of the eight topics that we'll be hosting. And initially, there's a video with experts discussing the topic that people can listen into. There's also a book. We don't require you to have the book at the library, but you can purchase a copy from the Foreign Policy Association. And then after having watched the video, the facilitator will lead people in a conversation to learn, but also to express views, to have some debate. I think it's a really wonderful opportunity for people.
Sure. And this is an open discussion. I think it's fair to expect there might be some anger, disagreement. It's a contentious topic.
It is. And I think that's what the strength of the Great Decision Program is, that it is not a one-way conversation. We do have some facilitators and a video that kind of gives us the voice of some of the experts on the topic. But it really puts the onus on the participants to have a conversation. You know, so much in a democracy depends upon having an informed citizenry. And I think the Great Decision Programs, particularly with foreign policy issues, gives people the opportunity to speak their mind, hear an opposing viewpoint, and create a process for civic conversation. And that's what I think democracy is all about.
What are the most common questions you might anticipate at this discussion?
Well, the common questions will relate to the topic itself. So if it is shifting alliances in the Middle East, or if it's ISIS and a second topic, or to do with Cuba or with any other changes in the world, they will be topic focused. So I think in terms of the shifting alliance in the Middle East, I'm sure a lot of the questions would be about what are the differences between a Shia and a Sunni? Why are Saudi Arabia and Iran on opposing side of the political spectrum in the Middle East? What's the real story about ISIS? And so all of these can be questions. And of course, people do come in with strong opinions, which we which is very helpful, and we welcome that.
And the library is such a wonderful venue to have this conversation, of course.
Absolutely, because we're a neutral venue. We're open to everybody. We very much embody the democratic spirit. And so please come. There are various topics, 8 and all, on Thursday evenings. Go to jackspubliclibrary.org on our website to find out the exact dates. But the first one is January the 14th at the Southeast Regional Library at 6:45 in the evening. And we really welcome people to come and learn, but also participate in debate.
Right. This is a week from Thursday at the Jacksonville Public Library Southeast Branch. That's the one near JTB and Gate Parkway. That's the one where we go for math tutoring, by the way.
Everything can happen at your local public
that's
library.
That's the thing. Like, there are people that are doing all kinds of things, including taking their kids there to meet the math tutor. That's what I do when I go over there. And as you said, Barbara, there will be all sorts of topics. This is a series. Now, this is the first in the series.
Absolutely. There'll be a whole range of topics. The topics are determined by the Foreign Policy Association with the book that I just mentioned. And so the topics will include the Middle East, as we've just said, the future of Kurdistan, migration, the Koreas, the United Nations, climate change, and Cuba and the United States. So a whole variety of important issues.
All important issues, but you know what? I think this is the hottest of them all. So you're kicking
most
it off
topical.
with a really hot topic.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will be well attended. Now, this is free. Open to the public? Do people need to register or can they just show up?
No, people can just show up. We don't expect them to register. There will be the opportunity to get on a mailing list so that if you want to be reminded of future programs, and we also prepare reading lists so you can come and debate, but then become even more informed by checking out a book or downloading a book from your local library to learn more on the topic.
Always good to do. And I need to get over there and hand in some overdue books, by the way. Maybe I'll do that if I swing by this discussion on the 14th. They'll be very overdue by then, by the way. It's Shifting Alliances in the Middle East, hosted by, of course, none other than Dr. Parvez Ahmed, PhD. He is UNF's Fulbright Scholar and Associate Professor of Finance at the Kagan College of Business. Dr. Ahmed, more informed than probably anyone else in town on these issues. Again, this is Thursday, January 14th, 6:45 p.m. at the Jacksonville Public Library Southeast Branch, JTB and Gate Parkway. That is at 10599 Deerwood Park Boulevard. Free and open to the public. Come on out and learn about this very important topic. Coming up next week, Barbara Gubbin and Parvez Ahmed. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for hosting us.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. Our show theme, composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to the Daily Podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, President Obama meets with Attorney General Loretta Lynch and FBI Director James Comey to discuss possible executive action on gun control. Diane discusses the president's potential moves and the ongoing debate over how to curb U.S. gun violence. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.